Good day. Today is Saturday, 21st March 2026. And just to remind everybody again that today I will be travelling to the English countryside. My wife and my family have suggested to me that following my birthday yesterday, and by the way, thanks to everybody who has sent me greetings on my birthday, I have been thrilled and honoured to receive them all, and there have been many, just to say. But anyway, following their advice and urging, I'm taking a short weekend break in the English countryside, and I will be back on Sunday evening, so it'll be normal programming on Monday. But today's programme is likely to be shorter than usual, and tomorrow's programme definitely will be. In the meantime, obviously, I will nonetheless cover the news as it arises, despite the fact that the programmes, as I say, are likely to be shorter. Well, with that, let's proceed. And let me first, as I now invariably do, remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel if, once you've watched the programme, you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate the fact. Now, over the course of the last 24 hours, we have had extraordinary contradictory statements coming from the President of the United States and from his officials. Firstly, there's been a cascade of reports all over the media that the United States is now seriously considering some kind of ground operation against Iran, that the plans to move forward with that ground operation are being worked upon. There is talks again of capturing Kharg Island. There is talk, alternatively, of capturing some of the islands around the Strait of Hormuz, presumably as part of some larger operation to break the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Though I should say how the capture of one or two islands in this area would achieve that, given that what the Iranians are doing is launching drone and missile strikes on tankers and perhaps and attacks on tankers with underwater drones, and perhaps eventually the Iranians also have plans to mine the Strait of Hormuz, all of which I discussed in previous programs, including my program yesterday. Anyway, what exactly the capture of one or two small islands close to the Strait of Hormuz would achieve in terms of ending the blockade and enabling ships to pass the Strait of Hormuz, it completely escapes me. In fact, as I will discuss later in this program, such plans seem to me to be misguided, misconceived strategically, and likely to cause many more problems, even in political economic terms, than they will solve. But anyway, we've had that messaging coming out of the United States. Then we've had alternative messaging coming from the President of the United States and Donald Trump himself. Firstly, he is now clearly and obviously very angry with the US's European allies. He is calling them cowards. He says that NATO without the United States is a paper tiger. By the way, he's absolutely right about that, and that will continue to be the case. But anyway, that is what he's saying. He is also saying that all of the military operational objectives have been almost fulfilled. This is very close to some of the comments that were made by Prime Minister Netanyahu, which I discussed in my program yesterday. But all of the major military objectives have been achieved, that Iran's ability to enrich uranium has been destroyed, that the Iranian nuclear program has been obliterated. Of course, he said all of that after the June 2025 12-day war and was extremely critical, to put it mildly, of anyone who contradicted him. He said that any claim that Iran's nuclear program had not been obliterated as a result of the American bombing strikes on Natanz and Fordow and Isfahan, that any such claims were fake news. And he was extremely, extremely critical of anybody who said that. Now, he's saying the same thing all over again. He's saying that the Iranian nuclear program, which had been obliterated in June, has been apparently obliterated all over again, 6 months later, or 10 months later. Anyway, that's what he's saying. He says that Iran's military capabilities have ended, and in a frankly not very coherent Truth Social post, he's gone further and he said that the Straits of Hormuz is not really important to the United States. The United States itself is self-sufficient in energy. Well, he doesn't actually say that, but that's the implication. And that it is for the local countries, for the Gulf states and other countries that rely on energy exported through the Straits of Hormuz, once the war, the current war, is finished, it is for them, not for the United States, to patrol and guard it and to ensure freedom of navigation through it. And, well, again, many people are treating all of these comments about Iran's military defeat, the destruction of its nuclear enrichment program, plus these comments about the Strait of Hormuz not being especially important for the United States. Many people are seeing these statements as indicating that the president is indeed looking for an off-ramp, is trying to find some way to bring the war to an early end through some kind of presumably ceasefire, to which the Iranians would have to agree. And I'm going to say straight away, the messaging from Netanyahu, which I discussed yesterday, and the messaging from Trump, which I've just discussed today, is so similar that I cannot help but think that they've agreed it together. There was clearly a very tough, very stormy meeting between Trump and Netanyahu. I say stormy, I don't know how angry Trump became, but for the record, I've heard unofficially that Trump is now angry practically all the time, that his temper has become very short, and this makes it extremely difficult for people to advise him. But anyway, it looks as if some kind of argument perhaps took place. And anyway, one way or the other, the two of them together agreed their messaging, which is that Iran is defeated, the objectives have been achieved, the Iranian nuclear enrichment program that caused so much trouble no longer exists, Iran's ballistic missile construction capability that Netanyahu was talking about, he says that that doesn't exist either. The war is won. The military objectives have been achieved. The Iranian leadership have all been assassinated. And the Strait of Hormuz isn't really that important anyway. And it's for others to worry about it. Well, as I said, to me, all of that looks like an attempt to bring the conflict to some kind of early end. The trouble is, for all of the reasons that I have been discussing on this channel since well before the conflict began, all of the reasons that have been discussed by many others, the reasons that were first, I think, highlighted by Alistair Crook, who, of course, has access to the Iranians, which I absolutely don't, the reasons which the Financial Times set out in a long article, which I discussed about a week ago, and the reasons which we discussed on the Duran. Well, for all of these reasons, the Iranians are not taking this message. They have repeatedly said, as by the way, the Russians have repeatedly said, that they are not interested in temporary ceasefires. They fully expect, if they agree a ceasefire now, that at some point in the future, another attack upon them will come. They've come to the conclusion, about which, by the way, they are absolutely right, that the true objection about Iran in Israel and the United States is not its nuclear enrichment program. There are many countries around the world which enrich uranium, many of them on very good terms, friendly terms with the United States. It's not its nuclear enrichment program. It's not even its ballistic missile program. Saudi Arabia, for example, has a significant ballistic missile program. And for the record, the Saudi Arabia, as I remember, launched its ballistic missile program back in the 1980s with assistance from China. And there have been rumours that it also obtained assistance from North Korea. So all of the same people who helped or may have helped Iran with its ballistic missile program, as the some Americans and some Israelis say, undoubtedly did assist Saudi Arabia with its ballistic missile program. What the Americans and the Israelis really object to is the political, the governmental system in Iran. They seek its overthrow. It wasn't overthrown after the June 2025 war. It still has not been overthrown. If there is a ceasefire now, that problem will still exist. And inevitably, at some point, given the fact that this issue remains unresolved, sooner or later, in some form or other, one way or another way, the United States and the Israelis will return again to their effort to overthrow the political system in Iran. Now, as it happens, today is the start of Nowruz, the celebrations of the new year, which are celebrated in Iran and in many of the Central Asian states. And by the way, just to anticipate, there's been an exchange of messages between the Iranian and Russian leadership in connection with the start of Nowruz. But before I get on to that, it's perhaps worth saying that the new supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Muqtada Khamenei, has now published a further statement to the Iranian people on the topic of Nowruz and on the occasion of Nowruz. And I will return to this, to the various things that he said over the course of this rather long statement in this program. But at this point, I would just make two observations about his statement. Khamenei says in it that this current attack on Iran is the third attempt by the United States to achieve regime change in Iran. He says that the June 2025 war and the January protests were the first two attempts. This is the third. And he also links in this statement the very existence of Iran as a state, as a nation, to the survival of the political system there. He obviously says an awful lot about Islam. His statement is filled with Islamic imagery, as you would expect from a member of Iran's clerical establishment. But I was struck more by the very nationalist, the specifically nationalist, patriotic tone of this statement, which contrasts with statements that I have read of his father. And in the statement, what Muqtada Khamenei says is that the ultimate objective to be achieved through regime change by the United States and Israel, their ultimate objective is to disintegrate Iran. He actually uses those words. In other words, to break up Iran. He conflates, Muqtada Khamenei conflates the survival of Iran as a state and as a nation with the survival of the political system there. Now, in this, I should say, he's had massive assistance from all sorts of people in the United States and in Israel, who have thought aloud, as you might say, about what a wonderful thing it might be if the Iranian government, if Iran as a state, were indeed to break up, if it were to divide into its constituent parts, so that there would be a Persian-speaking rump surrounded by an independent Azerbaijan, an independent Kurdistan, an independent Arabic-speaking Khuzestan in the oil regions of the south, a Baluchi region in the east, all of those things. Anyway, I don't myself believe that these are real practical possibilities. I think that those who make these claims and have spoken in this way are unfamiliar with Iranian history and the extent to which the various nationalities that make up Iran, different though they are, have through long history become integrated with each other. But the point is, put that aside, and I'm not an expert on Iranian history. The fact is that these commentaries, these statements have been made by people in Israel and the United States. They are the same people who have been advocating relentlessly an attack on Iran. It's entirely understandable why there should be people in Iran who do believe that this attack on Iran is not just an attack on the current political system, but on the state and nation as a whole. And of course, inevitably, given the strong patriotic feeling that many people in Iran have, their pride in their history and their civilization, all of this is likely to act as a consolidating factor within Iran itself. So, given that this is the thinking amongst Iranians, or at least the thinking that Muqtada Khamenei, who is, after all, the supreme leader, is expressing, given that it is likely to be shared by many officials within the Iranian leadership and perhaps within wider Iranian society, it's completely understandable why there would not just be a consolidation around the current political system, but why all talk about temporary ceasefires is simply not something that should be entertained. Because a temporary ceasefire, which results in a further, even more powerful attack on Iran in future, a temporary ceasefire which opens the way for further economic suffocation of Iran, which places the entire country under constant and continuous siege, opens the way not just for regime change in Iran, which of course the stakeholders who have an interest in the preservation of the current political system, who probably include very large sections and perhaps a majority of Iranian society, would be bound to oppose anyway. Anyway, beyond that, they would want to avoid regime change. They would want to avoid Iranian people in general would probably want to avoid a situation of temporary ceasefires and resumptions of further and continuing attacks on Iran itself, because they would say that the objective is not just the elimination of the government, the regime, it is the disintegration of Iran itself. So the Iranians are not interested in these proposals from the President of the United States and from Netanyahu for temporary ceasefires. They made this very clear. All sorts of attempts to try and insinuate that they are interested or motivated to seek ceasefires for the moment are completely wrong. And we've seen several of them. We had that strange affair a couple of days ago when reports were circulating and flying around that the that Araghchi and Witkoff were exchanging text messages. Araghchi took no time to say that this was completely untrue and to try to, well, to discredit that story. The Iranians are not interested in any sort of temporary ceasefire or temporary or negotiation that will result in anything that will prevent anything. They do not want a temporary ceasefire that will simply open the way for further and bigger and more powerful attacks upon them in the future. And I don't know exactly how it's been conveyed to the president, but he has had this communicated to himself as well, because shortly after he made all of these statements about how victory has already been achieved, he, of course, also came out and said that he's not interested in a ceasefire. I'm going to say it straightforwardly, I don't think he's telling the truth here. I think everything on the contrary, all of his other statements, the statements that Netanyahu made, clearly show that if a ceasefire were on the table, a ceasefire which he could present as some kind of a victory, he would take it. What he can't, of course, accept is that the Iranians are saying no ceasefire. Donald Trump is somebody who must always get what he wants. He must always come out the winner. So if the Iranians are telling him, we don't want a ceasefire, he of course comes round and says, well, I'm not interested in a ceasefire anyway, even if all of his other messaging points in the other direction. And of course, the president, Donald Trump, has to also face the fact that despite all the claims, all the rhetoric about how Iran has supposedly been defeated militarily, how it is incapable of continuing the war, he has to face the fact that the Iranians aren't getting that message either. They continue to strike back, and they are striking back constantly and all the time. I was reading in Bloomberg that Iran, since the start of the war, has launched 3,000 missiles. By the way, and for the record, that is double the amount of missiles that Iran was supposed to have in its stockpiles, according to some reports I remember reading before this current iteration of the conflict began. Larry Johnson at Sonar 21 has pointed out that the United States can have little clear understanding of how large Iran's missile stockpiles really are, given that most of the missiles are apparently stored underground. And, well, this statement from Bloomberg that the Iranians have launched 3,000 missiles confirms that that is true. And, well, the Iranians continue to launch missiles. As I've discussed in recent programs, as a number of people, other people have done, as Brian Beletic has done, after the first massive surge of missile launches that took place in the early days of the war, the Iranians have settled at a more stable launch rate of 30 to 50 missiles a day, even though they've also shown that they can spike it up. They can spike it upwards when the need arises, as they did following the attack on the South Pars gas field. Following that attack, the Iranians actually, for about a 48-hour period, increased the launch rate of their missiles. Now, they have also now carried out a further missile strike towards the British island, the British territory of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. This is located apparently something like 45,000 kilometers from Iran. So the missiles that were launched, there were apparently two of them, that were launched against Diego Garcia must have been very long-ranged and very powerful. The US is claiming that the missiles missed their targets. And of course, we don't know what the target was. We don't know whether the missiles fell into the sea. We don't know whether they landed on the surface of Diego Garcia, whether the impacts took place somewhere other than at the actual giant base that the United States has on the island. I have no reason to doubt that the American claim that no significant damage to the base facilities in Diego Garcia was done, but perhaps that wasn't the point anyway. The Iranians, again, are demonstrating a capability. They're demonstrating that they possess weapons with the range to strike American bases thousands of kilometers from their territory. Of course, that also means that parts of southeastern Europe, where the Americans also have bases, in Romania, for example, are within Iranian range. And, well, we see that the United States has no ability, or has shown no ability so far, either to intercept the missiles or to prevent their launching. Again, to repeat a point I've made in previous programs, we have stopped hearing the endless repeated claims that Iranian missile launches have all or mostly been destroyed. It looks like either large numbers of these launches have survived, in which case the Iranian claims that most of the launches the Americans said they had destroyed were merely decoys. The Iranian claims were true. Or alternatively, far fewer launches were destroyed than the Americans are claiming. Or, which is indisputably the case, at least to some extent, the missiles are being launched from underground silos, of which, of course, the Iranians have had ample time to construct many. So anyway, the Iranians are continuing to conduct strikes. I am going to suggest that over and beyond whatever worries the Americans might have about Iran's ability to conduct strikes thousands of kilometers from Iranian territory against American bases in places like Diego Garcia and southeastern Europe, I'm going to suggest that an even greater worry are rumors, and they are only rumors, that an S-400 system has now arrived in northeastern Iran, and that its radars are successfully tracking F-35 and other stealth aircraft, and may have played some role in the damage done to the F-35 fighter jet, which the Americans themselves have admitted to. Incidentally, there are some speculations that even though the pilot of the F-35s apparently survived and the aircraft was able to escape Iranian airspace so that its very sophisticated systems were not compromised, The aircraft itself had to conduct a hard landing, what's described as a hard landing, in Saudi Arabia. In other words, it was unable to land at an airfield and crashed in the desert. Perhaps all those reports about helicopters being deployed to the crash site were intended to retrieve the sensitive parts of the aircraft. Anyway, that the aircraft itself is a write-off. There's very little information, as one would expect, about what has happened to this F-35. And I'm not going to guess or pretend that I know more about it than I do. The point is that if the S-400 is indeed operating in northeastern Iran and is indeed successfully tracking US stealth aircraft, then that might indeed change the picture. And that the Iranians have indeed been training on an S-400, that I know with certainty. I was provided with information about it some months ago. I spoke about how Iranian technicians started to train in Russia on operating an S-400 system in the first half of last year. I was told by the very, very reliable source which gave me this information that the Russians, according to the Russians, it takes about a year for technicians, operators of an S-400 to gain sufficient knowledge to operate the system. Though it would ideally require 2 years to gain full operational proficiency. Well, perhaps that year has passed. Perhaps the S-400 is now deployed on the territory of Iran, presumably in northeastern Iran, which is, I won't say it's beyond the range of American and Israeli aircraft, but it's a more difficult territory for them to reach. And it's also very mountainous and heavily forested in many places. So it would be relatively straightforward, by the way, to conceal systems there. Anyway, maybe it is operating. And there have been many reports that its radars do have a capability, a certain capability to track stealth aircraft. Perhaps not fully so, but at least to some degree. To repeat again, I am not a technical expert in these questions. But anyway, even a limited capability to track and engage stealth aircraft is going to be a serious matter for the Israelis and for the Americans. And it is going to further limit their ability to conduct operations inside Iran itself. One thing I am absolutely sure, there is going to be much discussion, much debate, much worry and concern within the American and Israeli military leaderships about how it was that Israel was able to, sorry, that Iran was able to engage with an F-35. There will be many people who will ask how it happened. Was it due to pilot error? Was there some mistake made? Or does Iran now have a capability that went previously unsuspected? And could it be that that capability is connected to the supply of the S-400, perhaps in combination with the very long range radars, early warning radars, which Iran has apparently received from China. Anyway, there it is. All of these factors remain in play. The key thing to say, however, is that the underlying calculus of the war, the Strait of Hormuz, continuing to be controlled by Iran, which controls access to the Persian Gulf or from the Persian Gulf, that remains in effect, and that there is nothing, it seems, that the Americans and the Israelis for the moment can do about it. Now, obviously, if there is an S-400 system functioning in Iran, that can only have happened with a green light being provided by the Kremlin, by Russia. And as I said earlier in this program, we now do in fact have reports. We do have now an interesting exchange of messages between Russia and Iran on the occasion of the start of Nowruz. And let's first go to the Kremlin. Because Vladimir Putin, on the occasion of Nowruz, has sent greetings to various leaders whose countries celebrate Nowruz. So Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. Putin, by the way, has pointedly said that Tajikistan is a strong ally of Russia. He has just commended Tajikistan as a close ally of Russia. And of course, it was in Tajikistan that we saw this enormous convoy of trucks moving towards Iran with the truckers flying Iranian flags that I discussed yesterday. I said almost certainly the supplies were coming from Russia and they're travelling to Iran via Tajikistan. And here we have Putin now talking about Tajikistan as a close ally of Russia. But then, amongst the various congratulatory messages that Putin sent on the occasion of the start of Nowruz, the Kremlin's website has this. Nowruz greetings were also sent by President Putin to the Iranian leaders, Supreme Leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Sayed Mokhtaba Hosseini Khamenei, and President Masoud Pezeshkian. Vladimir Putin wished the Iranian people strength in overcoming their severe trials and emphasized that during this difficult time, Moscow remains a loyal friend and reliable partner of Tehran. A loyal friend and reliable partner of Iran, of Tehran. Loyal. And the Iranian media have given their own account of Putin's words. And I'm now going to the Iranian readout of this message. President Putin of Russia wished Iranians a happy new year, saying that Russia is a loyal ally and partner for the Islamic Republic. Putin assured Iranian leaders and the people that Russia remains Iran's loyal ally and partner during these difficult times and hopes for a successful resolution to the US-Israeli war. Now, I have not, of course, seen the actual text of the message itself, which was sent to the Supreme Leader and to Pezeshkian. But notice that the Russians say that Putin spoke about Russia being a loyal friend and partner of Iran, and the Iranians take it further. They say that he spoke of Russia as a loyal ally and partner of Iran. Well, there is a difference, but I don't think it is actually such an enormous one. I could see that the Kremlin, which continues to position itself as some kind of, well, shall we say, broker in potential future peace talks between the between the Iranians and the Israelis and the Americans, might in its public statements wish to avoid the word ally, but perhaps over-focus on the word ally misses what I think is the even more important word, the word that both the Kremlin and the Iranians say was in this message, which is the word loyal. Whatever the exact nature of the relationship between Russia and Iran, whether it is an alliance or whether it is just a friendship, the point is that Russia is loyal to Iran, which of course translates to Russia being prepared to provide assistance to Iran. Clearly, there is no fully fledged security and alliance arrangement between Iran and Russia. According to the Russians actually suggested it at some time in the past, but the Iranians refused it, just as the Russians at some point in the past, according to Putin himself, suggested that Russia and Iran work together to create a comprehensive air defense system in Iran, something which Iran, unfortunately, at least the Iranians will say was unfortunate, clearly lacks. So it would be for Russia to decide how much assistance it is going to give to Iran. But when the Russians use a word like loyal and talk about friend and partner, and of course the Russians have made no secret of their view that Iran has been the target of aggression by the United States and Israel. They have repeatedly used that word. I've been reading in the Financial Times, for example, that the Russians have said very little about the war and have been muted in their criticism of American and Israeli actions. I have absolutely no idea what the Financial Times here is talking about. The Russians have been completely forthright about what they have said. As I said, they have had no hesitation describing the attack on Iran as an act of aggression. But anyway, given all of this, given that Putin is also saying that the Russians want to see Iran come through successfully these difficult times that Iran is experiencing, what that tells us is that the Russians almost certainly are telegraphing, not just to the Iranians, but to the world in general, that they are providing some level of assistance to Iran. Now, this could be intelligence assistance. In fact, I have no doubt that that is being provided. It could be assistance with training of drone operators, Shahed operators, based on Russian experience in the Ukraine war. Of that, again, I have no doubt that that has happened. It could be reverse technology flow. The Russians originally bought the original plans from the Shahed from Iran and then established their own production and took the Shahed, the original Shahed, and modernized and updated it and have now produced the Geran family of drones, which we see operating in Ukraine. And we're starting to see various types of Shahed drones appearing in Iran, which appear to resemble in so many ways some of the new Geran family of drones that I can't help but think that, as I said, there's been some reverse technology and engineering flow. And the Russians, as I discussed in various programs recently, appear to have provided the Iranians with water drone technology, which the Russians themselves acquired from Ukrainian water drone technology, which paradoxically itself appears to have originated in Britain and the United States, and which the Iranians have actually used against tankers in the Persian Gulf. And, well, the messaging boards of the Russian parliament, the Duma, are full of stories about Russia providing food and economic assistance to Iran to keep it, to sustain it through the war. So something is happening between these two countries. And whilst I don't know that an S-400 system is now operating in northeast Iran, I have to say, I would be very far from surprised if it was the public signalling that is taking place between these two countries, Russia and Iran, at least suggests it. Anyway, in the meantime, the war continues. And as I said, we have to now face the question of whether there is any reality to these various military operations. The capture of Harg Island, the capture of the islands in the Straits of Hormuz, the deployment of ground troops, all of that, whether there's any truth to these stories. Now, I overestimated the number of Marines that the United States appears to be deploying to the region. I said that in a recent program that the assault force might number 3,000 troops, but this was based on a misreading of the number of helicopter carriers that the United States appears to be deploying to the region. It looks as if the actual deployments will not be three, but perhaps two. And it seems that the number of actual infantry that is carried in these helicopter carriers is around 800 each. So we're looking at perhaps 1,600 men, half the 3,000 man force of assault troops that I'd thought about in previous programs. Obviously, there is the uncertainty about what the 82nd Airborne Division might be up to, but just to say again that so far that hasn't appeared on the scene, and that too is a light infantry force. Now, yesterday, all of the talk was about Harg Island and about capturing Harg Island. Today, as I said, it's all about, or at least some of it is, about capturing some of the islands close to the Strait of Hormuz. I've already said that I don't understand why the United States believes that the capture of these islands near the Strait of Hormuz is going to make any difference to the underlying reality that the Iranians can stop shipping passing through the Strait of Hormuz. As Larry Johnson has repeatedly pointed out, if the Houthis were able to stop shipping pass through the Red Sea, exit the Red Sea, then the Iranians, even if they lose one or two islands, can prevent shipping passing through the much narrower Strait of Hormuz, which at one point is apparently only 21 kilometers wide. So seizing islands is not going to make any difference. There is a narrative starting to develop in the United States, advocated by people like Lindsey Graham, that seizing Harg Island will somehow precipitate a huge crisis in Iran, and that it will force the Iranians, the shock of losing Harg Island and the ability to export oil will shock the Iranians into some kind of capitulation of the sort that the United States wants. And of course, Donald Trump himself apparently has been harping on about Harg Island going all the way back to the 1980s, when apparently he first started to talk about this issue then. Now, I have to say, based on the comments that the Iranians themselves are making, I think that this is another massive miscalculation. I've already spoken about how Harg Island itself could easily become a military trap for whatever US military force is sent to capture and occupy it. But there is something else that I think American planners, assuming that there are any, and assuming that they are being listened to, are failing to take into account. Given that the Iranians apparently fear that any kind of truce is simply going to lead to further future attacks upon them, which would result in the collapse of the existing political system and ultimately the disintegration of Iran. Given that the Iranians assess the stakes so high, why would they agree to stop simply because Kharg Island has been captured? For the moment, Iran is able to maintain a financial flow by exporting oil. And the United States has said that it's not going to interfere in Iran's export trade. It's actually issued a statement, a decision, saying that Iranian oil, which is at sea, is not subject to sanctions. Another admission of the enormous economic pressure that the United States and its allies are under in light of the closure, or at least the control, the Iranian control of the Strait of Hormuz and the actions that the Iranians are taking there. But let's say Kharg Island is captured. Let's say the Iranians aren't able to export energy any further. Would that in itself lead to the collapse of the political system in Iran? I am unable to see why. The point is that Iran would be at war. It would have part of its territory, Kharg Island, occupied by an invader who the Iranian people are being told, and who many of those people no doubt believe is seeking the disintegration of Iran. Surely in that case, the Iranians will do something completely different. They will move towards a full mobilization war economy, in which there would be centralized control of supplies and allocation of resources, greater reliance on economic aid provided by key strategic allies like China and Russia, and which would almost by definition require less capital inflow than a civilian economy would do. And given the creation of that kind of economy, one can see that the economy, that kind of economy, would actually strengthen the current political system still further, and that many of the key players within that system would in that case probably link the preservation of the political system in Iran to the continued operation of the Iranian economy in exactly that form. So at that point, the calculation might be, let's keep the war going because we have a mobilization economy, with a war economy, if you prefer, and we also, as a result, have a stable political system. The worst possible decision would be to agree a truce, to end the war, but to leave the United States in control of Kharg Island, preventing Iran from exporting oil, making it impossible for a civilian economy in Iran to function, and in that case, perhaps causing an economic crisis which might undermine, finally, the stability of the political system and of the entire regime. So capturing Kharg Island might not actually force the Iranians to seek peace. It would give the Iranian leadership a further reason to continue the war, so that when the war ended, the Americans were obliged to leave Kharg Island because the war had ended in an Iranian strategic victory. Well, that seems to me logic, a logical calculation, and it's the kind of calculation which I wonder whether people in the United States are making, whether even now they understand the sort of calculations and ideas that are being made in Tehran. And coming back to that statement by the current supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, what do I in fact find? But over the course of this statement, he says this: resistance economy in light of national unity, security. And the Iranian media is saying, leader announces slogan of new year. So it's difficult to see that as anything less than the Iranian leadership already preparing the Iranian people for precisely the kind of centralized mobilization economy that I've just been talking about. And, well, that kind of economy, as I said, is not going to be affected by the loss of Kharg Island. Stability in Iran, economic and political, would only be jeopardized by a peace which might result in pressures to move away from such an economy at a time when the Americans still retain control of Kharg Island. Capturing Kharg Island, assuming that is even possible, which I doubt, by the way, for reasons many have discussed, including myself in previous programs, looks to me like a plan, a recipe for an indefinite war. Anyway, there we go. We will see what happens over the next couple of days and hours. In the meantime, I've been looking at the figures, the energy prices. You can find them, by the way, every day if you go to oilprice.com. You see where all the various grades of oil, what level of prices they reached. Just before I started making this program, I saw that Brent crude, which had dipped briefly after President Trump made his statement, which some people interpreted as a possible sign that he was seeking some kind of off-ramp. Well, Brent crude, just before I started making this program, was trading at $112 a barrel. So that's where we are. Probably, if the war continues, it will move higher next week. And we've did a program on the Duran with Raed Sukarno, in which he discussed the way in which events might unfold in global energy markets the longer this crisis is prolonged, and the effect this will have on the global economy and the financial system. There is an article, incidentally, today in The Guardian, the British newspaper, The Guardian, which speaks of growing anger within the British government, the behaviour of the United States and its decision to launch the war, at the way in which this is causing havoc on British government economic planning. I wasn't aware that the Starmer government, as a matter of fact, conducted much in the way of economic planning, but the Guardian says they were, that the government had hoped that interest rates would fall. They now have to worry about interest rates going higher, that will precipitate a recession, that Britain is in no condition to cope with a recession. I suspect that these debates, these discussions, are taking place all over the world, in Europe, in Germany, in France. There's discussions and anger about this in Japan, which is particularly affected. And, well, the new Japanese Prime Minister has had the comforting assurance from the United States, from President Trump himself, that the surprise attack on Iran, of which Japan was not previously advised, well, that's not really any different from the Pearl Harbor attack, which is what the Japanese did. So really, Japan, when you think about it, there's nothing good to complain about. I don't know what Takaichi thought about that. I don't know what people in Iran are thinking. Now, I'm going to finish with one final point, which I'm going to make, which is I've discussed the sort of assistance that the Russians might be providing to Iran at this time. We have less information about Chinese assistance, but I am sure that there is Chinese assistance being provided. It's just that I'm less well informed about it, and I'm not that well informed even about Russian assistance. But one of the things that the United States constantly over relies on when embarking in conflicts in of this kind is its technological prowess, to the point where the United States has let its militaries shrink as it has become increasingly addicted to ever more sophisticated, ever more technologically complex weapons systems, which even the United States itself can only afford in relatively small quantities. What is happening as a result is that the United States no longer has the bulk to bring to bear in conflicts that it once did. But what I think that the United States always overlooks is that if it comes to technology, the other side has it too. Certainly the United States has stealth fighter jets, but so do China and Russia. Certainly the United States has advanced missiles, but so did the Chinese and the Russians too, and in much greater numbers, and operating from a bigger and better organized military industrial base. The Russians and the Chinese also have bulk, which the United States does not. Bloomberg, in that article that I spoke about, where it spoke about Iran having launched 3,000 missiles, talks about the enormous stress this has put on the American and Israeli air defense systems. Well, the Russians and the Chinese are able to produce missiles, air defense missiles, in sufficient numbers where they can absorb things like that. Just saying. So, ultimately, the longer a conflict continues, the more the other side, if it is minded to, if the Chinese and the Russians, to be precise, are minded to, can start to provide their ally, Iran in this case, with advanced technology, as they did in the Korean and Vietnam wars, just to say. And that can certainly reduce American technological advantages, even as America is increasingly limited in its ability to bring bulk to the conflict. It is another reason why the United States, it seems to me, should aim for a short war, or at least should try to get out of this war as quickly as it can. At the moment, there is no word of the Russians and the Chinese, for example, assisting Iran in other ways by helping Iran operate advanced fighter jets, perhaps from Central Asian bases. But of course, the longer this conflict goes on, the more possibilities like that, which may seem very far-fetched at the present time, grow. Beyond a certain point, whatever assistance the Russians and the Chinese are giving to Iran now, as the war continues and the Russians and the Chinese become ever more invested in sustaining Iran, the longer it goes on, the more both the temptation and the imperative to step up help for Iran in Moscow and Beijing will increase. And of course, the Russians and the Chinese will also make the calculus that at some point, by doing that, they gain leverage over the United States as well as Iran, as they did in both the Korean and even more the Vietnam Wars. So it is absolutely not in American interest, economically, politically, militarily, for this thing to drag on. If there are no good military answers, and there are none, the emphasis should be diplomatic. It should be talking to the Russians, primarily the Russians at this time, to see what the way out might be. If that leaves a stronger, angrier, more vengeful Iran able to dominate the Gulf, well, there it is. That was a reason for not starting this conflict in the first place. Now that that mistake has been done, it might no longer be possible to undo it. But in the meantime, the longer this thing drags on, the greater the risks and the dangers for the United States are going to be. Well, this is where I'm going to finish mostly my program today, but I will just return briefly to the situation with Ukraine. Firstly, the Russians have said that they are boycotting the next meeting of the Americans and the Ukrainians. They're not sending a delegation to it. They're leaving the Americans and the Ukrainians to talk to each other. One wonders about what and to what possible end. For the moment, at least, I get the sense that the Russians have lost all interest in the negotiating process. Kirill Dmitriev quickly shot down the story that he had told the Americans in his own bilateral discussions with Witkoff, that if the Americans stopped help to Ukraine, Russia would in turn cease providing assistance to Iran. It is inconceivable that the Russians would suggest that kind of quid pro quo at this point. Notice again that statement in the Russian readout to the Iranians that Russia is a loyal friend. Clearly, those reports that appeared in the American media were intended to make trouble between the Iranians and the Russians, And at this moment in time, it makes no sense for the Russians to play along with that idea. For the rest, the Europeans continue to function on automatic pilot. They continue to try to harass the Russians. Another Shadow Fleet tanker, this time flying the flag of Madagascar, was seized in the Mediterranean. This in the middle of a global energy crisis, even as the Americans are trying to loosen restrictions on oil supplies in order to stabilize the situation in global markets. Emmanuel Macron, like Don Quixote, tilting at windmills, and with Sancho Panza, Keir Starmer, helping him along. Apparently the British played some role in this operation too, or so they're telling us. They're still seizing Shadow Fleet, as they like to call it, tankers, pushing further up, further the price of oil, further upwards, annoying the Americans, acting at cross purposes with the Americans, who, of course, benefits most from higher oil prices at the moment. Of course, it's the Russians. And the Russians, as they've said, their own tankers, flying their own flags, operating around the world oceans, will receive naval escorts. And Nikolai Patrushev, Putin's aide, has now confirmed that there might indeed be armed men on board some of these tankers from this point going forward. This is an idiotic decision to make. It was presumably made some time ago. Nobody in Paris or London seems to see the sense of bringing it to a stop. One senses that we're looking here at Emmanuel Macron's petulant reaction to try to stop a petulant reaction after the Russians showed his envoys the door when they came to Moscow back in February. Once again, we see how emotion and vanity and a sense of infinite superiority in Europe result in stupid decisions being made. And at this particular point in time, this is one of the stupidest ones. But anyway, for the rest, I'm not going to discuss the situation on the battlefields in Ukraine today. There are rumours that another big Russian missile and drone strike on Ukraine is about to happen. There's also further discussions about Konstantinovka and Slavyansk. So that will be the topic for future programmes. To remind you, I am now going to the English countryside. My next programme will be short. I'll be seeing you there. And until then, remember to tick the like button, check your subscription to this channel, look us up on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. Check out our shop, support us via Patreon and Subscribestar. And above all, have a very good day. Thank you again. More from me soon.